Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 52. It's July 10th, 2020. Every journey begins with questions, and here are three. How does a penniless Russian tennis club with one indoor court create more top 20 women players than the entire United States? How does a humble storefront music school in Dallas, Texas, produce Jessica Simpson, Demi Lovato, and a succession of pop music phenoms? How does a poor, scantily educated British family in a remote village turn out three world-class writers? Talent hotbeds are mysterious places, and the most mysterious thing about them is that they bloom without warning. The first baseball players from the tiny island of the Dominican Republic arrived in the major leagues in the 1950s. They now account for 1 in 9 big league players. The first South Korean woman golfer won a Ladies Professional Golf Association tournament in 1998. Now there are 45 on the LPGA Tour, including 8 of the top 20 money winners. In 1991, there was only one Chinese entry in the Van Cliburn Piano Competition. The most recent competition featured 8, a proportional leap reflected in top symphony orchestras around the world. Media coverage tends to treat each hotbed as a singular phenomenon, but in truth, they are all part of a larger, older pattern. Consider the composers of 19th century Vienna, the writers of Shakespearean England, or the artists of the Italian Renaissance, during which the sleepy city of Florence, population 70,000, suddenly produced an explosion of genius that has never been seen before or since. In each case, the identical questions echo. Where does this extraordinary talent come from? How does it grow? The answer could begin with a remarkable piece of video showing a freckle-faced 13-year-old girl named Clarissa. Clarissa, not her real name, was part of a study by Australian music psychologists Gary McPherson and James Renwick that tracked her progress at the clarinet for several years. Officially, the video's title is Shorter Clarissa 3.mov, but it should have been called The Girl Who Did a Month's Worth of Practice in 6 Minutes. On screen, Clarissa does not look particularly talented. She wears a blue hooded sweatshirt, gym shorts, and an expression of sleepy indifference. In fact, until the 6 minutes captured on the video, Clarissa had been classified as a musical mediocrity. According to McPherson's aptitude tests and the testimony of her teacher, her parents, and herself, Clarissa possessed no musical gifts. She lacked a good ear. Her sense of rhythm was average, her motivation subpar. In the study's written section, she marked, "because I'm supposed to," as her strongest reason for practicing. Nonetheless, Clarissa had become famous in music science circles, because on an average morning, McPherson's camera captured this average kid doing something distinctly unaverage. In 5 minutes and 54 seconds, she accelerated her learning speed by 10 times, according to McPherson's calculations. What was more, she didn't even notice. McPherson sets up the clip for us. It's morning, Clarissa's customary time for practice, a day after her weekly lesson. She's working on a new song entitled Golden Wedding, a 1941 tune by jazz clarinetist Woody Herman. She's listened to the song a few times. She likes it. Now she's going to try to play it. Clarissa draws a breath and plays 2 notes. Then she stops. She pulls the clarinet from her lips and stares at the paper. Her eyes narrow. She plays 7 notes, the song's opening phrase. She misses the last note and immediately stops, fairly jerking the clarinet from her lips. She squints again at the music and sings the phrase softly, da-da-dum-da, she says. She starts over and plays the riff from the beginning, making it a few notes farther into the song this time, missing the last note, backtracking, patching in the fix. The opening is beginning to snap together. The notes have verve and feeling. When she's finished with this phrase, she stops again for 6 long seconds, seeming to replay it in her mind, fingering the clarinet as she thinks. She leans forward, takes a breath, and starts again. It sounds pretty bad. It's not music. It's a broken up, fitful, slow motion batch of notes, riddled with stops and misses. Common sense would lead us to believe that Clarissa is failing. But in this case, common sense would be dead wrong. "This is amazing stuff," McPherson says. "Every time I watch this, I see new things. Incredibly subtle, powerful things. This is how a professional musician would practice on Wednesday for a Saturday performance." On screen, Clarissa leans into the sheet music, puzzling out a G sharp that she's never played before. She looks at her hand, then at the music, then at her hand again. She hums the riff. Clarissa's posture is tilted forward. She looks as though she is walking into a chilly wind. Her sweetly freckled face tightens into a squint. She plays the phrase again and again. Each time she adds a layer of spirit, rhythm, swing. "Look at that," McPherson says. "She's got a blueprint in her mind she's constantly comparing herself to. She's working in phrases, complete thoughts. She's not ignoring errors. She's hearing them, fixing them. She's fitting small parts into the whole, drawing the lens in and out all the time, scaffolding herself to a higher level. This is not ordinary practice. This is something else, a highly targeted, error-focused process. Something is growing, being built. The song begins to emerge, and with it, a new quality within Clarissa." The video rolls on. After practicing Golden Wedding, Clarissa goes on to work on her next piece, The Blue Danube. But this time, she plays it in one go without stopping. Absent of jarring stops, the tune tumbles out in a tuneful, recognizable form, albeit with the occasional squeak. McPherson groans. "She just plays it, like she's on a moving sidewalk," he says. "It's completely awful. She's not thinking, not learning, not building. Just wasting time. She goes from worse than normal to brilliant, and then back again. And she has no idea she's doing it." After a few moments, McPherson can't take it anymore. He rewinds to watch Clarissa practice Golden Wedding again. He wants to watch it for the same reason I do. This is not a picture of talent created by genes. It's something far more interesting. It is 6 minutes of an average person entering a magically productive zone, one where more skill is created with each passing second. "Good God," McPherson says wistfully. "If somebody could bottle this, it'd be worth millions." This is a simple idea. Clarissa and the talent hotbeds are doing the same thing. They've tapped into a neurological mechanism in which certain patterns of targeted practice build skill. Without realizing it, they have entered a zone of accelerated learning that, while it can't be bottled, can be accessed by those who know how. In short, they've cracked the talent code. All right, so that is just a part of the introduction to a book called, surprisingly, The Talent Code. Daniel Coyne, maybe I'm going to go find the author's name for you real quick. It's a great book. He wrote another book several years later called The Culture Code, which is also really cool. Yeah, Daniel Coyle. And I'll obviously link to it in the notes at regular.fm/52. It's a wonderful book. It gets a lot into what's going on in the brain that to me is much less interesting. I guess it's validating because it's corroborated in the physical world in a sense. Though really what I'm most interested in is the practice of it and the how of it, what we're supposed to do, the thoughts we think and the actions we take. It's fascinating stuff. Early on in these dispatches, I read a great bit featuring Jerry Seinfeld interacting with, I believe, Harvard Business Review and being asked if he'd ever considered McKinsey or other consultants for his show. Since he quit after 9 years with the number one show, why not keep going longer? Could some help have made it more efficient, given him more staying power? And his response was perfect. He said, well, I don't know. Are they funny? And they said, no. They said, I would have no use for them at all. And then he went on to say he didn't care at all about efficiency. That was not the point. And he micromanaged everything. He was focused on creating the best show, and it needed to be funny. And that's all that mattered. Efficiency be damned. And that's a 100% valid point of view and important. And yet it's really inspiring to read about this video of this psychologist studying how this young musician is learning and practicing and developing and beginning to realize that there is a way to practice that is, I think, both at the same time. Like in the Seinfeld world, in a sense, metaphorically here, it's like, is it funny? Is she playing better music? Is she getting there? Is there going to be punch in this? And yes, there is. And it turns out that she's accomplishing a month's worth of practice in just 6 minutes. And it has a lot to do, I think, with she's slowing it down. She's deconstructing it into elements. And she's working on each element. And when she makes a mistake, she stops. And she might slow down further. She'll back up and work her way back to the point of mistake, to the point of failure, and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it until she gets the mechanics of it. And things too, like I love the writer does a good job of the attention to detail here, painting for us the picture of the video. She's leaning in, she's squinting, she's completely focused. There's no smartphone, there's no distraction, there's nothing else. She's focused on this. She's paying attention. She's working at it. She's humming herself. She's moving her hands. She's fully engaged. And mistake, repeat, mistake, repeat, mistake, repeat. And I simply have to say, like, it's wonderfully inspiring, and it says a whole lot. It's like fractal. All of these things we're facing, the problems that we're all facing, they're very fractal in nature. They're your problem. They're your neighborhood's problem. They're your family's problem. They're the country's problem. It was fascinating reading Clark Ulrich talking about studying microcosms, whole systems in miniature. And it's incredibly critical. Get to failure, fail, 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 because that is actually the process of growing and building. And it just reminds me so much when you read about, we went through Kyle Bass, just the very beginning of Boomerang, which covers the impending collapses of national finance, sovereign states and their debts. And we're all under this great pretense that we're not surrounded in failure. That's Japan, they'll talk about the lost decade that now has been lost decades. And part of it is they simply won't write down the value of the assets. They won't face the reckoning that's coming. And so QE infinity and all of this kind of stuff, it's like, at what point are we going to admit failure and let these things fail? I'm still mystified. We will let airlines go bankrupt. The airplanes do not fall out of the sky. They continue to fly. The employees continue to show up to work. But things happen, such as the common stock is written off and the debt holders are forced to go through a bankruptcy proceeding, and they're not going to get 100 cents on the dollar. And we have these major financial institutions that we bailed out through TARP. And apparently now Dodd-Frank means TARP. They can spin up a TARP whenever they want to anymore. And back then, where Paulson and Geithner had to go to the politicians who had to, in public, debate and pass things. They no longer have to do this anymore. They can just spin out tarps to infinity whenever they need it. And to a degree, this is all of us now losing failure, losing mistakes, losing the errors, Coyle put in here this wonderful phrase that it was an error-focused process. That's a beautiful thing. And it's something that's inspiring for all of us. I don't know about you, but sometimes when I go to learn something new as an adult, maybe I'm now over the hill, I'm old enough that can't teach old dog new tricks kinds of nonsense starts to seep into us. And maybe it's because we get uncomfortable with failure. I watch my daughter around this house, and she just is failing all the time, but she's learning all the time. She's building all the time. There's no division between the two. There's no, her view of herself and her concerns about any kind of standing with respect to other people don't come into it at all. She's just expressing herself. She's engaged in being alive. And as a byproduct, she's like learning. And it is very error focused. It's really cool to see. So I'm trying to make sure, trying to wake myself back up and remember what that is like and not do it again. Because while it's true, Jerry Seinfeld is right. Can they help make it funny? Then I don't need them. Focus on effectiveness. Focus on making it funny. Where's the punch? And yet it's also really inspiring. The bit from yesterday, I think it was yesterday, and James Clear talking about Kobe Bryant and his workouts, the sheer magnitude and size of them, the quantity of it is astounding and stands out even amongst his peers, the other Olympic basketball players. By definition, the best in the world. In addition to outworking them in sheer quantity, he really outworked them qualitatively. And the example of an hour spent by player A and player B practicing free throws, and how much more you can accomplish in any given unit of time. It's really amazing stuff. There's a whole bunch more to go through from there. I almost stacked up like two or three more readings for this edition, but I decided not to. I'm going to hold back. It gives me something to lead off with on Monday, Tuesday, or save for later. There's so many bases to cover and all this kind of stuff, and it's wonderful. It's a river that keeps on flowing, so I'm excited about that. I will tell you, because I'm kind of now making this part of the routine, it's after 5:30 on Friday. I waited till the end of the workday to sit down, and I'm going to do more work tonight, but I waited till this time of day to knock this out. I was up before 5 this morning. Again, that's great. Jocko Willink style. Go look at Jocko Willink on Instagram and his aftermath posts. This guy, former Navy SEAL, total badass. He will take a photo of his watch around 4:30 in the morning when he gets up, and he'll post another photo after he's worked out. That's how he starts his day. And his point is it's never gotten any easier. It's still hard. He still does it anyway. And I'm in a tiny little way trying to just start getting up early. Today, I will say I did get up early. I didn't do all that much, actually, in the first hour of the day. Made some coffee, piddled around with some email. Did do a little reading that's useful. I mean, it's actually useful. That was nice. And right now, though, the main focus is just get up and get going. I do really want to get, for y'all and for myself, where I'm posting these between 6:30 and 7 in the morning at the latest every day. We'll see how it goes. Y'all have a great, great weekend, and talk with you soon.